From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The phenomenon of animal migration is being threatened by a range of things, from cell phone towers to climate change. Migrating birds, butterflies, fish, whales, and large mammals are in trouble. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with David Wilcove. His new book, No Way Home, is not only about the decline of the world's great animal migrations, it's about why animals migrate and how they know when and where to go. Also, we listen to wild baboon vocalizations recorded in Botswana by Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfrith, who have studied baboons in the wild. They've collected their findings about the social behavior of baboons in their book Baboon Metaphysics. Lots of animals coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might not be aware of this, I know I wasn't, but the phenomenon of animal migration is disappearing around the world. The migrations of birds, butterflies, fish, whales, and large mammals are threatened by factors ranging from cell phone towers to climate change. My guest, David Wilcove, is the author of the new book, No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. The book is not only about why migrating animals are threatened, it's about why these animals travel and how they know when and where to go. Wilcove is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University. I asked him why threats to animal migration matter to us humans.
Animal migration in general is a really important phenomenon. It's, I think, just about the most spectacular thing in wildlife to see great herds of mammals in Africa or flocks of birds here. But it's also important ecologically. So in the case of the birds, for example, as these billions of migratory birds move back and forth every year, they're consuming vast numbers of insects, and they're really helping to preserve the health of forests.
What else? What are the other ways that migratory animals keep things in balance and affect the lives of humans?
Let's take a look at something like salmon. So salmon are born in streams, rivers. They migrate out to the ocean. They grow really big, and then they come back upstream, they spawn, and they die. From an ecological perspective, what they're really doing is gathering nutrients up in the ocean, coming back up to the rivers, spawning, dying, decaying, and releasing those nutrients into the rivers and streams, and from there it gets onto the land. And it can be very important in terms of maintaining the health of not just the rivers, but also the adjacent land. So, for example, studies have shown that a significant fraction of the nitrogen growing in grapes in California, in the wine country, is actually nitrogen that was brought there by salmon. In essence, they're transporting nutrients and helping to maintain the productivity of the rivers and the adjacent land.
Now, you write in your book that the closest you can get to actually flying with the migrating songbirds is to travel with Martin Wachelski, who's a professor of ecology at Princeton, where you're also a professor of ecology. And you've accompanied him on at least one of these missions, studying the migrating birds. How does he actually track birds?
Martin is an absolute genius at finding ways to study migratory birds. And he and his colleagues have developed very small transmitters that they can attach to a thrush. They release, capture the thrush, attach the transmitter, release the thrush, and then as the bird migrates in the evening, they pile into a car or into an airplane and they chase after it. Usually they're in a car, and they're careening through the Midwest late at night trying to keep up with this bird that's 1,000 feet above them heading north in the springtime. And they then try to recapture the bird so they can obtain some key data relating to its physiology and in that way determine what the costs of migration are. But he's done some amazing studies not only with birds but also with dragonflies to understand how individual animals migrate and what it means to them.
That's really amazing, you know, that he can attach a little transmitter to a small and fragile dragonfly. And for anyone who's confused about which insect the dragonfly is, do you want to describe the dragonfly?
Sure. The dragonflies, to me, look like little fixed-wing airplanes. They've got a long, slender body and two sets of wings that are held out. And they weigh about, the species that Martin was working on weighs about 1/30th of an ounce. And he was able to develop a transmitter that weighs 1/100th of an ounce.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's right. And he attached it to the belly of dragonflies using some super glue and eyelash adhesive. I'm not sure how he figured out to use eyelash adhesive. And I was with him for much of this work. You release the dragonfly, and then he tracked them while they migrated in a small airplane. And we...
Wait, he was in a small airplane while they migrated?
That's right. And we discovered that dragonflies migrate much the same way birds do. They have their migration days and their rest days. And when they migrate, they can go considerable distances. One of the dragonflies that we tracked moved over 80 miles in a single day.
So what are some of the more interesting things you've learned about migration through studying these dragonflies?
We were quite surprised to learn how closely they followed the behavior of migratory birds, not only in terms of having the travel days and the rest days, but also they put on fat prior to their migration, the way a bird does, kind of stocking up. And then dragonflies...
It doesn't show.
No, they carry it well, but they definitely need that extra energy for these long trips. One of the neat things about dragonflies is they weigh so little, a hundredth of an ounce, that they really can't afford to fly against the wind. And most of the time, we found that they were migrating in the direction of the wind. Well, you would think to yourself, that's not a very sensible approach. How is it going to get you where you want to go? But in fact, they have a very simple rule that they seem to follow. It must be an ingrained rule. And that is, they wait until they have two nights of successively colder temperatures. So if Monday night is 50 degrees and Tuesday night is 40 degrees, they will fly on Wednesday morning. And the reason this seems to work is in the autumn, falling nighttime temperatures usually mean a cold front is coming through. And that means northwest winds, which gives them a tailwind in exactly the direction they want to go. So it's a very simple rule that evolution has developed that helps them with their migration.
Now, doesn't this lead us directly into the problems of climate change, that migratory animals will be getting the wrong cues at the wrong time?
That's right. They may operate under different sets of cues. So, for example, a migratory bird in the tropics may use the change in day length, which can be just very subtle, just a few minutes a day, but it can pick that up, and it may use that as the cue that it's time to come back north. On the other hand, the insects that it depends on for its food, they may depend on temperature. So as the earth gets warmer, it's possible that the insects will appear earlier, but the bird in its wintering grounds, either in Africa or Central America, won't know that. And so it arrives when it has always headed north, only to find that its food is much less abundant because the insects have already come out and disappeared.
You know, in terms of migration, you say climate change is the joker in the deck. The ultimate effect on migration is as yet undetermined. What do we know so far about how climate change is affecting migration patterns?
The problem with climate change is it can disrupt some of the very carefully honed relationships between birds and their prey, for example. In Europe, the pied flycatcher, a small songbird, has been declining because it times its arrival on its breeding grounds to the growth of the caterpillar population, and it tanks up on those caterpillars and feeds them to its young. But with global warming, the caterpillars have been coming out earlier and earlier. The flycatchers on their wintering grounds in Africa don't know that. And so they've been arriving at the usual times on their breeding grounds only to find that there aren't enough caterpillars to raise their offspring. And these sorts of problems are likely to occur in many other parts of the world, including the United States. In other cases, climate change could simply erase important habitats for migratory species. Sea turtles, for example, have very specific nesting beaches where they come ashore, lay their eggs, and these nesting beaches can be used for decades or even longer. Climate change could easily result in a rise in sea level and the complete disappearance of these vital nesting beaches.
My guest is David Wilcove, author of the new book, No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Wilcove. He's a professor of ecology at Princeton University and author of the new book, No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. Now, one animal you write about was in decline and has made a comeback is the gray whale. What turned things around for the gray whale?
The gray whales represent one of the few real success stories in saving a rare migratory animal. And they undertake an amazingly long migration from the Bering Sea down to Baja, California, where they pile into a few lagoons in Baja, which function as sort of a nursery where the females give birth to the calves, and a singles bar where the unmated male whales pair up. And when the whalers in the 1800s discovered these lagoons, they quickly decimated the gray whale population. And so by the beginning of the 20th century, the gray whale was down to a handful of individuals, and it seemed as though it was destined for extinction. But they were protected, and then later on, an international treaty was developed to protect the great whales. Meanwhile, the Mexican government took steps to protect these lagoons, and the great whales staged an amazing comeback from probably less than 100 individuals to well over 20,000 today. In fact, great whales today are probably as common as they have ever been. And it's been a great boon for ecotourism because there are lots and lots of companies and individuals that take tourists out to see the whales, either along the west coast of the United States where they migrate or down to those lagoons in Mexico where they calve and where they hang out.
Now, you're right. As the gray whales became more valuable alive than dead, something remarkable happened to the whales themselves. They stopped fearing people. Would you elaborate on this a little bit? First of all, what you mean by the gray whales becoming more valuable alive than dead? And how did they stop fearing people? And were they attacking people before?
Sure. The tourism industry that has sprung up around gray whales, both in the United States and in Mexico, generates far more income than the dead whales could have via whaling. Now, back in the 1800s, the gray whale was called the devilfish. And the reason was it had the reputation of attacking the whaling boats. That's a little unfair to the whales because the attacks were primarily female whales who were attacking the boats to protect their calves because the whalers used to harpoon the calf first, knowing that its mother would not abandon it. And that meant they could kill the calf and then kill the mother. So the whalers viewed the gray whale as a very dangerous animal. The gray whale viewed humans as a very dangerous predator. And there was this antagonistic relationship. After several decades of protection, where the whales were no longer being harvested, something very strange happened. Mexican fishermen reported that when they were around the lagoons where the gray whales spent the winter, some of the whales were actually coming up to the boats and even allowing themselves to be scratched on the head, and they seemed to like it. And they would bring their young up to the boats to meet the people. And this has continued to the present day as more and more whales seem to seek out this sort of contact with people. And no one is certain what's going on, but my hunch is the whales recognize that humans are no longer a threat to them, and they are genuinely curious about people and boats, and I also think they like to get their heads patted.
Let's get really small again. In talking about the obstacles to migration, you say even a new road can wipe out, say, a species of salamander who has to get from one area to another. And you'd say that you even spent a day at Stanford trying to help salamanders, like endangered salamanders, across a road. Talk about these salamanders a little bit and what you did to try to help them and why you did it.
Sure. In California, in Stanford, there's an endangered salamander, the California tiger salamander, and they breed in a little pond, and then they move upland into the wooded and shrubby areas for much of the year. And separating the upland areas from the breeding pond is a road, and it's a pretty well-traveled road in terms of cars. And so when the rains occur and the salamanders are moving between the breeding pond and the upland area, concerned citizens organize brigades of students and people to walk along the road at night with flashlights, find the salamanders, and help them across the road before they get squished by cars. Because, in fact, lots and lots of them are killed every year by the cars. And since it's an endangered species, the loss could significantly harm that population. So it was one of the stranger evenings I spent, but probably one of the more productive ones. It was a rainy night, the cars are zooming by, and I'm walking along the road with a flashlight and a fluorescent vest and looking for salamanders. And when I see them, catching them, taking them across the road, and releasing them.
Now, this is exactly the kind of scenario that a lot of people who think environmentalists are kind of like silly liberals who don't have their priorities straight would mock. So tell me why it was important to you to observe this and participate in the salvation of these endangered salamanders.
For a couple of reasons. First, if you haven't seen a California tiger salamander, it's really a very beautiful animal. It's black with yellow spots, and I think it's quite an impressive little animal. Second, because it's an endangered species, we do have to worry about the loss of the individuals in this population. I frankly wouldn't spend all of my time helping every salamander try to cross a road, but I think in the case of an endangered species, it's well worth a small investment of time to prevent it from becoming extinct. As far as its ecological role, I'm not going to claim that the loss of the California tiger salamander would cause some great environmental disaster. But I do think they're a nice part of the environment and a reminder that in California, long before there were cars and people, there were also a lot of interesting wildlife.
You know, you end your book by saying migration is an act of faith. What do you mean by that?
We can look at a migratory bird, a thrush that's going to undertake a perilous journey from its breeding grounds in Canada to its wintering grounds in Brazil and think, what a brave animal. But birds really don't have attributes like bravery or faith or anything like that. What they do have is an instinct that tells them it's time to migrate, that tells them where to go and how to get there. But it occurred to me that instinct is the result of evolution. Thousands upon thousands of years of natural selection that crafted an animal that could do all of these things. And in essence, that genetic programming, that set of instincts, really amounts to faith, because the animal, while it's migrating, doesn't know what has happened to its winter home since the last time it was there. It doesn't know what happened to all of the important stopover places in between. It just feels a compulsion to go. And it seemed to me that, in a way, that's a hardwired faith. And that, of course, shows both the marvel of migration and the vulnerability of the animals that do migrate.
Well, David Wilkove, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
David Wilkove is the author of the new book, No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. From the families who own Cabot Creamery, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar since 1919, recipes and health tips are at cabotcheese.com. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lord John and the Hand of Devils, an adventure by Diana Gabaldone, author of the Outlander novels. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the grunts, screams, and calls of baboons and what they mean. We listen to baboon vocalizations recorded by Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth as part of their field research in Botswana. They're the authors of Baboon Metaphysics. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can tell by the title of the book, Baboon Metaphysics, that the authors want to know what's going on in the minds of baboons. The authors also want to know what baboons have to say to each other. They've recorded vocalizations of wild baboons and analyzed what they communicate. We're about to listen to some of those recordings with the authors of Baboon Metaphysics, Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth. This husband and wife team has studied baboons in Botswana since 1992. They both teach at the University of Pennsylvania, where Cheney is a professor of biology and Seyfarth a professor of psychology. Dorothy Cheney, Robert Seyfarth, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new book starts with a quote from Darwin, and the quote is, "He who understands baboon would do more towards metaphysics than Locke." What is Darwin talking about?
Well, Darwin wrote that in 1838, quite a while before he published The Origin of Species. And he wrote it in one of his notebooks. He kept voluminous notebooks. And his idea was people were very interested at the time in where thinking comes from, why humans think the way they do, why they perceive and organize the world the way they do. And he began to realize that he could take his theory of evolution by natural selection and apply it to the brain, and in so doing, apply it to the way people think. And he suddenly realized that if humans are closely related to non-human primates, like the baboon, that by doing a comparative study of the way non-human primates think and the way humans think, you could begin to understand how thinking evolved.
Do you feel that through your research you're learning about the human brain and thinking and how it evolved?
To some degree, of course, baboons aren't humans, and they lack language and a lot of the sort of mental capacities that humans have. But one of the things that's been intriguing to us about baboons is that they live in these very complex societies that are composed of multiple family lines, individuals of varying degrees of competitive ability and dominance ranks, and so on. They seem to know a huge amount about each other's social relationships and each other's dominance ranks. So the social complexity, on the surface anyway, appears to be very similar to that of a very complex human society, and yet they're not humans. So the question is, what differentiates us from them, and what sort of selective pressures might have gotten us from an organism that looks like a baboon to an organism that looks like us?
Well, let's listen to some of the vocalizations that you've recorded of baboons, because these are just amazing to listen to. And we're going to start with grunts. We're going to hear six different baboons back-to-back with the basic grunt sound. So what should we be listening for?
Well, as you go through this tape, you're going to hear the calls of six females. Each one of them gives two grunts. And you'll notice that the grunts of any one female, the two that she gives, sound alike. But they sound very different from the next animal, who's different from the next animal, and so on. So that you can easily imagine that if you were a baboon living all your life with these different individuals, you very quickly learn to recognize, oh, that's Helen, that's Sylvia, and so on.
Okay, so here it is, six female baboons, back-to-back, grunting. Okay, so does each baboon have their own note, basically?
Yeah, you can think of it that way, although it's a little bit more complicated because it's like six different people saying the same word, but each individual is a little bit idiosyncratically different.
Now, were they all recorded together at the same time? Is that a conversation we heard?
No, and not in this particular case, but you could easily have a conversation like that because a typical social interaction might involve a female walking up to another who has an infant grunting and that female with an infant grunting back. So you do get these kinds of vocal exchanges. And the vocal exchanges are actually most common when animals are embarking on a potentially dangerous move through deep water, for example. And they're given almost as a sort of exchange to kind of negotiate. Are we really going here or not? Are you keeping an eye on me or not? I mean, that's an anthropomorphism, but the sort of looks exchanged between animals as they give these grunts, it's as if they're checking to see what each other's intentions and motivations are.
We have a scream we're going to hear, a baboon scream. When do baboons scream?
Well, they scream when they're involved in a fight, and typically the screams are given by a lower-ranking animal to a higher-ranking animal. I should have added earlier that when we're talking about rank in adult females, rank is not determined by size or age. It's determined entirely by who your mother is. And so when you're looking at a dominance hierarchy of females, there could be 26 females ranked in a hierarchy where female 1 can supplant or cause to move away female 2, and female 2 can cause 3 to move away, and so on down the line. What you're really looking at is groups and clusters of families where females 1 through 4 could be mother, daughter, and sister. And then female 5 belongs to an entirely different family. So that a lot of these fights and altercations and kind of negotiations that I was talking about involve not just individuals, but entire families.
Well, let's hear a baboon scream. Now, that really sounded like a bird to me. Do you hear that a lot when you're out in the wild with the baboons?
You do. And what you often hear is you hear a sequence of calls, say, from over somewhere behind a bush, you hear one animal giving a threat grunt to another animal and the other animal screaming. And this is what baboons hear all the time. And this is what we wonder, what do they know? What sort of information do they get when they hear these calls? And the interesting thing is that you can use these sequences to show that the baboons know something about each other's ranks. So if we take from our library of calls the threat grunt of a high-ranking female and play it followed by the scream of a low-ranking female. So let's say Sylvia is a high-ranking female and Hannah is a middle-ranking female. If we play Sylvia's threat grunt and Hannah's scream, then that's the sort of thing that happens all the time. And animals don't usually respond. But if we dig into our library and get two different calls, Hannah's threat grunt and Sylvia's scream, and we put them together in a sequence and we play that, the animals will look toward the speaker and try and figure out what is going on. They have a very strong response because that sequence suggests that Hannah is threatening Sylvia, who we all know to be higher ranking, and this violates their existing knowledge. Baboons respond with surprise to anything that signals that the dominance order isn't exactly what we know it to be, which suggests that they really understand the rank relations that exist among others.
So you have these hidden speakers in the wild, and you play back baboon sounds for the baboons and see how they respond.
Exactly.
Pretty interesting. Okay, next we're going to hear a female baboon alarm bark. What is this?
Well, baboons in the area where we study, they are preyed upon by lions and leopards and also crocodiles. And when they see any one of these predators, they give a very sharp bark, the females do. And other animals immediately become very vigilant and may run up into a tree.
Well, let's hear it.
And that's a chorus of females giving barks to what was a lion on that occasion.
So hearing all of these different sounds, it sounds like baboons have a fairly wide range of things that they can communicate, different sounds. It's not just a trademark kind of singular sound.
They've got a repertoire of calls. Mm-hmm. And if you think about comparison with humans, what is striking is that the repertoire of calls, though it's certainly there, and a lot of them express subtle nuances of mm-hmm. aggression or subordination, it's really only about 10, 15, maybe 20 different vocalizations, so mm-hmm. that it's a relatively small repertoire.
And what separates these calls from human language is they appear not to be learned. So that if you go to East Africa and you hear a baboon threatening another, you'll hear a threat grunt. If a Kenyan baboon is giving an alarm call to a lion, it will sound very much like the same sort of call that a Botswana baboon gives to a lion. So you don't have any real dialects as you do in language or as you do indeed in birds. So in that sense, their vocalizations are very, very different from human language.
Though some people say we're born with that we're hardwired for language, even though we're not born knowing the words.
That's certainly true, but there's still more flexibility in the sense that, you know, you can teach an individual any language in the world.
Right. And baboons just speak baboon.
They just speak baboon.
Right. Well, let's get to another baboon sound. And this is what you describe as wahoos. Do you want to describe what wahoos are?
Well, in baboon society, as Dorothy said, the females are born and they live in the same group throughout their lives. And they live in this hierarchy of matrilineal families where the mothers and their sisters and daughters all retain really tight relationships with each other, lots of grooming, support in alliance, and so on. When males get to be fully adult size, sometime around 7 or 8 years old, they leave the group where they were born, and they go often miles away and join another group where they have to fight their way to the top of the male dominance hierarchy. But as in so many animals, there's a lot more displaying and posturing than there is actual fighting. And one of the real clear-cut and obvious displays that male baboons give to each other is this wahoo call. It's one of the loudest calls that any terrestrial animal makes, and males make it in sort of contests where one male will start wahooing and the other will respond, and then the males will run up into trees and leap from branch to branch while giving these wahoos.
And they're just kind of showing off. And
they're showing
over
off
each other.
And they're showing off, but also these are not just displays of complete bravado, because in order to sustain this very loud, rapid calling rate as you're racing through the trees, you have to have pretty good stamina. And so males seem to use these sorts of displays to display and also to assess each other's stamina and competitive ability, so that they actually serve a function that allow males to assess whether or not they want to escalate the display into a real physical fight.
Okay, well, let's hear a sequence of three different baboons doing wahoos. So these are very loud when you're actually in the wild with them.
Yeah, they're really loud. And you notice that there's the sort of wahoo, and it's a sort of two-part call. And if, as Dorothy says, the calls are kind of a contest to see who's the most powerful, who can wahoo the loudest, the longest, the fastest, and still not be out of breath. And as the males go through these wahoo contests, the who begins to drop out, and other sort of aspects of the call make it sound a lot less impressive.
Now, you refer to the importance of rank in baboon society, and there's also calls for low and high-ranking males that you've recorded. Would you explain what we're about to hear with these calls?
Well, what you're going to hear is a wahoo from a high-ranking male, and he's high-ranking, so right now he's at the top of the hierarchy, and he's in great physical shape, and everyone is deferring to him. And contrast that with a wahoo of a low-ranking male who's at the bottom of the hierarchy. He may be very old, he may be wounded, he's in not-so-good shape. And listen to the different wahoos, and you can really hear the difference between one, the high-ranking male that really is powerful and has a long who, and the other one that's pretty pathetic, really.
Here we go.
So when you hear the first one, wahoo, and then the second one, the who is completely gone, wah. And that's the best that that low-ranking male can do. And it sounds much less impressive than the high-ranking males.
My guests are Robert Seyfrith and Dorothy Cheney, authors of the book Baboon Metaphysics. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfrith, and they're the authors of the book Baboon Metaphysics, The Evolution of a Social Mind. They've been studying baboons for years in Botswana. They're also both professors at the University of Pennsylvania. They've been married for about 30 years. In addition to studying baboon vocalization, baboon language, one of the things you've been doing in the wild is collecting baboon feces. What can you learn by analyzing their feces?
One of the things that's been really interesting about the developments in poop, I guess you would call it, is that it's now possible to extract hormones from fecal samples. And as a result, you can, in our particular case, what we're looking at is stress hormones, glucocorticoids. And one of the beauties of a poop sample is, of course, you can gather a fecal sample without actually stressing the animal by capturing it or having to draw its blood. And so one of the things these fecal samples do is they allow us to measure stress, and it gives us, in a sense, we can interview the animal almost by asking her, what's causing you stress? How do you alleviate stress? And so it's a wonderful tool that allows us to actually delve more deeply into the baboon social structure and look at how animals deal with the many challenges that they face in their environment, including predation, infanticide, rank upheavals, and so on.
Yeah, so what does stress out baboons?
Well, there are three things that are really important for both females and males. And the first is predation. There are months in which lions attack the baboons,
lions
or
leopards
attack. And the collection of these thousands of poop samples from 22 females over several years has shown us that in months when there are predator attacks, everyone's glucocorticoid levels are higher So they're under a little bit more stress, it would appear. If a female is taken by a predator, of course, everyone's glucocorticoid levels go up, but the individuals whose glucocorticoid levels go up the greatest are the victim's relatives, the members of her matrilineal family or her closest grooming partners.
Well, that's interesting because it shows that family matters, that there's a special connection between family members in the baboon world.
It is, and collecting these fecal samples tells us something that we wouldn't otherwise know. I mean, everybody looks like they're under stress after a lion attack, but the fecal samples, the glucocorticoids, tell us that really under stress are the relatives of the victim. But then, of course, in the next few weeks and months, animals' glucocorticoid levels go back to baseline, and we were interested to see how this is achieved. And the females who lose a close relative or a close grooming partner, who have their sort of network of friendships disrupted, they show an interesting pattern. They increase the number of other females that they groom with, as if they're seeking out new friends to reestablish a nice, tight grooming network. And that's interesting because the same sort of thing happens when the females are faced with the potential of infanticide. When a new male comes in, he often tries to kill the small infants of females in the group at the time. And the females respond by forming a tight bond with another one of the males in the group, kind of friendship. And the females who are able to do that, their glucocorticoid levels don't go up as much as everyone else does who doesn't form a friendship.
You use the word infanticide. Why do new males in a group try to kill the infants?
Well, from a male's perspective, an immigrant male's perspective, it makes a lot of sense. In baboon society, all females breed, regardless of their relative ranks. But that's not true of males. The males who achieve the most matings is the dominant male, the alpha male. And the other males really don't do so well. The problem is there's such high turnover in the alpha male position that a male can only expect to be alpha male for about 6 or 7 months, maybe up to a year at most. So a male coming into a group faces a dilemma. There are all these infants in the group. The mothers are not going to start cycling again or become sexually receptive until those infants are weaned. Typically, an infant is nursing for over a year, and pregnancy lasts for 6 months. So the chances that a male will be able to retain his alpha position for long enough before these females become sexually receptive again is very small. So from a male's perspective, coming in and trying to kill the infants of lactating females makes sense. After all, these are not his infants. And if these infants are killed, then the female resumes sexual cycling soon. From the female's perspective, this represents a significant loss in her reproductive success. So, of course, they resist it.
So does the new alpha baboon want access to, like, every female baboon? I mean, it's not enough that some of them are already accessible. He has to kill the babies of the mothers who are lactating?
In a sense, yes. If a male comes into a group, there may not be that many cycling females present in the group. The odd thing when you look at a group of baboons like this is you can see this new male come in and he's infanticidal. You know, you can't help but as an observer respond negatively to this because horrible thing to observe. For a while you go through this period where you absolutely hate the male, even though you're supposed to remain objective. But what's interesting is that once the females he's mated with become pregnant and they produce offspring of their own, he becomes a doting dad. He protects these infants, he carries them, he lets them jump on his head, and so on. And so in some cases, these males who are alpha almost cede their position after they've produced some offspring of their own. They don't necessarily willingly give up the alpha position, but their efforts are devoted more to protecting their current infants than to fathering additional ones.
My guests are Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seiferth, authors of the book Baboon Metaphysics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth, and they're the authors of the book Baboon Metaphysics. They've studied baboons in the wild for years, and they've been married for about 30 years. They're also both professors at the University of Pennsylvania. The baboons can climb up into trees and take shelter there. Have there been situations in which you've had to hide from lions or tigers or any other animals of prey?
Everyone has at least one close call story, and my close call story was not watching the baboons, but when I was driving through the national park to the nearest town for supplies, and I got stuck in an enormously deep rut that I couldn't jack my car out of, so I had to walk back to the nearest ranger post, and I walked into a group of seven lions. And you're always told, do not run. If you run, a lion is like a sort of cat with a ball of yarn, it'll go for you, and you won't win. And so I moved as quickly at a walk as I could, about 15 meters to the nearest tree. And I climbed up the tree. And I was very glad that the tree at the time had knobs and little, you know, things that supported my feet. And I thought as I was going up, and I had these lions growling behind me, gee, this is just like climbing a ladder. It's great. And I made it up to the first branch, which was about 11 feet off the ground, and then I knew I was okay. And hours later, the lions finally went away, and I got help. And about a week later, we all went out and decided we would visit this tree and take some photographs and have a picnic. And it turns out that these little knobs and branches that provided me with footholds were only about a 32nd of an inch above the surface. They provided no support whatsoever. No one could climb the tree. Everyone all fell down. So I guess that's the beauty of adrenaline.
I know you've tried to keep like emotional distance from the baboons, and not influence their behavior or become too emotionally attached to them. Nevertheless, have you become very emotionally attached to them? And do you see them as beautiful animals?
Yes. And as animals with each one of them with a unique personality.
Recently, the oldest female in the group, Sylvia, died. And she was over 25 years old. And she was a real curmudgeon. And when we used to do these experiments that we did on looking at reconciliation, Sylvia never reconciled. She would cut. She was the second-ranking animal in the group, and her attitude seemed to be, you know, I should be first-ranking, and I'm just not happy about my life in general. Neither will you be as long as I'm around. And so she would cut the swath through the group and sort of beat up animals and so on. As she aged, she became a little bit more mellow, and she had a very close relationship with her only surviving daughter. And in a sense, that was the animal that she groomed with the most, and most of the other animals in the group, anthropomorphizing for a moment, really didn't want to be near Sylvia because she was such a nasty individual. And then this daughter was killed by a lion. And Sylvia, stress levels, of course, her glucocorticoid levels went very, very high, and she embarked on a kind of grooming campaign to try to identify a new grooming partner. Nobody would have her. Every time she approached anybody, animals would run away from her. And so she spent the last few years of her life pretty lonely. And then this past May, at the age of 25, she was seriously injured by a leopard. And she spent weeks off on her own trying to recuperate, and finally did. During this time, some of the low-ranking animals began to try to challenge her and try to, you know, oust her from a relatively high-ranking position, at which point her sister, who otherwise hadn't been paying attention to her for years, supported her and reestablished her bond and refused to let her be full in rank and so on. So we all have a great attachment to Sylvia, and when she recently died, I was emailing all of our former postdocs, and everybody wrote back saying, oh, Sylvia. One of the interesting things about these animals is that you don't try to anthropomorphize, but everybody kind of agrees on different individuals' personalities. So it's interesting that these personalities really emerge consistently.
During the last few years, while you've been pursuing your research, there's been a lot of controversy in the United States about whether evolution should be taught in schools or intelligent design. Having spent so many years of your life devoted to researching primate behavior and primate communication, what do you make of the fact that evolution became controversial again in the United States?
Well, I guess as biologists, we always regard this controversy with a bit of disbelief. I mean, evolution is the dominant organizing theory that organizes what we do in the biological sciences, and that includes the biomedical sciences as well. So many of the medicines we use, the pesticides we use, we make decisions about whether they're appropriate for humans based on comparative tests with animal studies that are based on the premise that animals are like us in many respects because of evolution. We can reproduce evolution in the laboratory, and in fact, it's particularly odd, just as we're beginning to know more and more about the relationship between genetics and behavior and physiology, all of a sudden the theory that guides us in those investigations becomes controversial. It's a little bit surprising.
I want to thank both of you so much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Well, thank
you're welcome.
You.
Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfrith are the authors of Baboon Metaphysics. They're both professors at the University of Pennsylvania. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Roberta Shirok, Ian Chillog, Joan Tui Westman, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. Jonathan Menhivar directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Juno is a new film about a tough, sardonic 16-year-old girl who becomes pregnant and decides to give the baby up for adoption. Critic A.O. Scott describes it as a feminist, girl-powered rejoinder and complement to the film Knocked Up. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the screenwriter Diablo Cody and director Jason Reitman. Join us for the next Fresh Air.